This is Masters of Dispute Resolution on PodClips. Masters of Dispute Resolution is designed to provide those involved in the mediation process with the views of the most experienced and accomplished mediators and others experienced in the process. Through our discussions, you will gain insight into how to address and overcome difficult issues and achieve more satisfying results in mediation. Your host is Len Levy, mediator and arbitrator with ADR Services, Inc., a leading alternative dispute resolution provider. Lynn litigated complex cases for more than 30 years and has been a mediator since 1998 and is a member of the National Academy of Distinguished Neutrals. He has been recognized as a super lawyer in alternative dispute resolution each year since 2014. And now your host, Lynn Levy.
Thank you, Daryl. Welcome, everyone. And thank you for joining us on Season 4 of Masters of Dispute Resolution, a podcast which will add tools to your mediation toolbox. We're brought to you by National Academy of Distinguished Neutrals and ADR Services, Inc. Now, in each podcast episode, you've heard a story about conflict, the impact that conflict had on the lives of the parties involved, how resolution was reached, and lessons to be taken from that conflict and its resolution. Now, many of the details you're about to hear have been modified to preserve the confidentiality essential to mediation, while also conveying the essence of the conflict and its resolution. Joining me today will be Brad Venning. Brad and I have gotten to know each other a little bit over the past couple of months. Brad is one of the most effective and well-regarded neutrals in, well, your bio says Northern California, but I think it's throughout the state. And Brad has mediated more than 2,000 cases throughout his career with an exceptionally high settlement rate, particularly in the areas of insurance, business, real estate, construction, intellectual property, corporate and partnership disputes, and professional liability. Brad has a reputation of being very, very thorough and gets to the core issues in mediation and can address what is at the heart of the dispute. His extensive trial experience and highly evaluative approach to settlement, coupled with a tireless commitment to the settlement process, have established him as a mediator whom clients can trust their most complex matters with utmost confidence and do. I mean, Brad is one of the busiest mediators around, and that speaks to his competence. And Brad, thank you for joining me today. And I'm looking forward to our story. Today, Brad is going to be sharing the story of a conflict that arose in the aftermath of the wealthy man's death when his family learned he had fathered additional children with an employee of his firm. The story is even more complex than that, but I'm going to let Brad tell it. So, Brad, take it away.
Sure. Thank you. So this was an unusual case for me. In general, I handle kind of business, real estate, construction, non-disclosure cases, partnership disputes, etc. However, as part of my practice, I had been defending lawyers for many years. And I had defended many trusts and estates lawyers because that is a very prolific area with regard to malpractice claims, because you can not only have claims by clients, but you can have claims by beneficiaries. And that's a very contentious arena, as I think probably most of you know. So because I had handled quite some number of trust and estates cases, tried a number of them, the trust and estates bar knew me. So I would also get trust and estates mediations. This was by far and away the most bizarre mediation because of the factual predicate of the case that I had ever had. So this gentleman, I will call him Bill, was a very wealthy, successful business person who had his own company, and he had run it successfully for many years. Bill had been married for over 30 years and had two adult sons. Bill developed a very serious form of cancer. He tried many different avenues. He went to Japan for some experimental treatment, also spent time in Europe, but that treatment ultimately was not successful. and Bill died. So after Bill's death, the wife was given notice, and I'll call her Susan. Susan was an executive at Bill's company and a long-term family friend, somebody that the wife had known for many, many years. Susan advised the wife of two things. One, that she has a 12-year-old son that is Bill's, that Bill has been supporting for many, many years. Shortly thereafter, the wife also received notice from a woman in Japan who indicated that she was not claiming she was married to Bill, but claiming that she had an infant son that had been born within the last year. So there were two different claims, at least originally, one by Susan for her 12-year-old son, and then one by this Japanese woman who was claiming that Bill was the father of her infant. So this is where the story becomes bizarre.
If it hasn't Bill, already, by the way.
Right, exactly. So Bill and Susan, for quite some period of time, in part because Bill was ill, had been going to an in vitro clinic and been trying to have her impregnated through in vitro methods. I think part of it also had to do with her fertility, not just his. So Susan, after Bill died, she goes to the in vitro clinic and forges his signature and claims that she has his consent to embark on another in vitro session. This in vitro session was successful. And 11 months after Bill's death, Susan gives birth to twins. So as you might imagine, this was a cacophony of claims, issues, legal issues, child support issues, and an emotion. At mediation, I had to be very cautious, and I had talked to the lawyers well ahead of time to say, listen, I'm very sensitive to personal issues, many times even in partnership disputes or family members have fallen out with one another. You have to be very politic and careful as to people meeting and having personal discussions during mediation. So where typically I encourage everyone, not necessarily my joint sessions, to talk, because I just talk myself to set the table as to mediation. But in this context, you might imagine the wife wanted nothing to do with ever seeing Susan. The two sons wanted nothing to do with ever seeing Susan. The wife didn't want to see the 12-year-old, and the brothers, at least originally, the two sons, didn't want to see any of their half siblings. Completely divorced, very antagonistic. As you also might imagine, wife was dumbfounded and tremendously angry, both at Bill and, of course, at Susan. And of course, then when she learned there was this posthumous pregnancy, she was completely in another emotional position, which you can fully understand.
Let me just interrupt here for a second, if I may.
Sure.
Because before we get into the session, what I'm wondering is, how was it presented to you by the attorneys? The typical brief, think that type of thing. And second question was, did you have conversations before the mediation session started with those attorneys to see what was cooking behind the scenes?
So, yes, and I typically, for every mediation, try to have pre-mediation calls just in general. But as you know, for this case in particular, I really needed to have a good understanding as to where the parties were emotionally, where the case stood legally, because there was a lot of legal proceedings with regard to establishing paternity and things that were in the background. So I had very extensive communications with the lawyers ahead of time. I then have asked them, because there had been quite some number of motions practiced and things with regard to what the legal obligations that Bill or his estate may or may not have to these kids. And so I had extensive information both through their law and motion proceedings and in letter briefs. And I believe, this is some time ago, they submitted both confidential, meaning confidential just to me, letter briefs and briefs that were open and available to all the parties. So setting the table for this mediation was particularly important. And it's kind of interesting. I've had to do this a number of times when I've had matters where a party or one or more parties may have restraining orders against one another. There was no restraining orders here. However, it was really important to the parties, at least, that they not run into one another in the hallway of the office where we were conducting mediation. So I had a baton And the only person who could go to the bathroom or leave their room, they had to be holding the baton, because we didn't want Susan and the wife to run into each other in the hall. We thought it would just be a kind of a complete catastrophe, probably.
Particular method I hadn't used before, and I wish because there are times, well, at least one time that in my practice where the parties had actually exchanged death threats prior to the mediation. So right. when emotions are running high, the last thing you need is interactions that are uncontrollable.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Len. Mm-hmm. So the other thing I will tell you, that at the very beginning of the mediation, very good lawyers in the case, they were not trying to throw gas on the fire. The lawyer for the wife was really making an effort, of course, to listen to her and understand her emotions, but not fan the flames. So I had a conference with all the lawyers at the outset to talk about the practical and personal issues that were involved in this, because they, you know, the legal issues were certainly important, but the practical personal side of this was really, you know, kind of front and center. So the good thing about that mediation was the lawyers had a consensus, even though they had strong differences as to what rights, you know, Susan and her children may have, what obligations the estate may have, etc. They very much were on the same page of trying to cool emotions and have this be something that was dealt with compassionately. And as you might imagine, especially with the wife and the two sons, and I know all of you who are neutrals have had this experience, many times at the beginning of such mediation, you need to spend a substantial period of time simply listening to them so they know you have really heard all the things they're concerned about, and be a very active listener. Doesn't mean you're endorsing their position or anything, but they need to know that you have thoroughly understood and heard their background. Certainly if they're going to listen to you, and it's also cathartic for them. So it provides them with an avenue to get rid of some of the anger and frustration they have with this very, very unique circumstance that they were facing.
And while you were doing that with one party, the others are having to wait. So I assume told them what to expect.
You know, I'd really actually try to do that in every mediation, but in that one in particular, when you know that you're going to have to spend time with one party in particular, sometimes it's the first party you're speaking to, sometimes it can be somebody else. I always try to set expectations so they're not offended and say, look, this is probably going to take me a half hour, maybe even take an hour, I don't know. It's very important, even though I believe in really trying to get down to brass tacks and talking, you know, real elements of potential settlement. Sometimes as a predicate to that, you really have to go through a lot of listening and discussion. And so I warn every party every time, pretty much. I try to say, listen, for these sessions at the beginning, when I'm really downloading my RAM and hearing from them what their concerns are, it'll take a half hour, an hour. So I try to set those expectations at the beginning so they're not offended.
Well, Brad, we're going to take a break now, and we're going to get down to the brass tacks of this mediation and how a negotiation of resolution took place. After we get back, I'm Len Levy, and we're chatting with Brad Benning.
Masters of Dispute Resolution would like to thank ADR Services Incorporated, your partner in resolution, and its founder, Lucy Barron, for supporting this podcast. ADR Services is one of the leading providers of alternative dispute resolution in California. Leveraging technology to drive resolution, ADR Services is committed to dynamism in the face of growing client need and an ever-evolving legal climate. Now operating offices in all major legal markets of California, ADR Services provides unparalleled in-person and remote resolution services through its exclusive panel, comprised of more than 130 of the most distinguished and talented neutrals across the state, capable of handling challenging and complex mediations, arbitrations, and other procedures in every field of law. When you seek the services of a neutral and you want results and satisfied clients, contact ADR Services, www.adrservices.com.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and my guest is Brad Benning, who is telling us a really interesting story that is about to get even more interesting, but I'm going to let Brad do that. So, Brad, take it away.
Sure. So by the way, folks, I've kind of couched this as the case of the posthumous pregnancy. Very unique. So in moving into the first mediation, the wife understandably was very skeptical as to these various claims. So the first thing that was necessary, and we had to negotiate in the first mediation session, because there were a number of them, was how were they going to go about establishing paternity? Not that difficult these days. There's a lot of technical methods they can do it. But what they did not want to do is have competing protocols or something that somebody didn't feel was credible. So we ended up negotiating, got an agreement as to how paternity was going to be established for a variety of blood tests, etc. That was dealt with before we even reconvened. It was clear that all of these kids were Bill's progeny. Second thing we had to deal with in this context of the mediation was who owned the sperm? Was it owned by the estate? Did Susan have a right since she and Bill had made an agreement with regard to having her eggs and his sperm at this in vitro clinic? Was it her right to use the sperm and for purposes of pregnancy? And of course, then one of the big issues was, did Bill give consent to a posthumous pregnancy? It's one thing to say that I'm alive, I want to have children with you, and we're both going to be working on that with this in vitro clinic. It's another thing to say, after he passed away, whether he gave either some kind of implied or before death express consent to Susan to go ahead and be impregnated. Well, Susan's position was that's one of the entire reasons we had gone to this in vitro clinic. So the other issue, or another significant issue, was Susan, who had admittedly forged Bill's signature with the in vitro company, did she even have standing with regard to this? Had she invited this problem of having children that did not have support, knowing that Bill had died at the time she was impregnated? So obviously the position of the wife is that you don't have any rights at all. You, in essence, waived any rights by impregnating yourself under false pretenses. The conclusion really was that the issue here is not what's in the best interest of the wife or Susan. The issue, of course, is what is in the best interest of the children. And I think the ultimate kind of better argument and conclusion in mediation was that Bill had given consent because he had had cancer, and one of the reasons, at least very plausible, that one of the reasons he had gone to the in vitro clinic to begin with is he did want to be sure he could have more progeny. So also is interesting because I'm not a family law specialist, and the lawyer was a family law specialist for each party, by the way, also involved in the case, and the issues with regard to the public policy in favor of child support. It's kind of interesting. For child support, you would have an order before death. If a child is born after somebody dies, they get a family allowance, a little bit different, couched differently, but the principle is pretty much the same. So one of the big debates, as you might imagine, is first, whether the child were going to get any kind of a family allowance, and then two, how was it going to be addressed? The wife did have a significant estate, and was there any method of her just writing a check, buying out of any further obligations on the part of the estate, and being able to dispose of any relationship whatsoever with Susan and with the children? So the challenge, of course, was also in the typical child support context, there is a balancing of what do the respective parents make? What is their ability to pay child support? Who has custody? So there's a variety of very complex things in the child, and there's formulas and so on they use in the child support arena as to how much child support should be provided. Well, Bill was pretty well off, and it was not very attractive to the wife to be giving to Susan each month, who had these three kids, a substantial amount of money. Her image was, well, how am I going to know if Susan's, you know, feeding him macaroni and cheese, or she's doing the right thing and sending him to private schools, or Susan is just going to go live in Monte Carlo, and I'm going to be basically giving her a stipend for the rest of her life, and I am not going to do that. So one of the big issues in resolution was finding a structure and a method where the wife wasn't going to feel, particularly Susan, not as much the woman in Japan, but particularly Susan, she had a relationship with, was going to feel that this wasn't just a complete windfall to Susan to get support for a substantial part of the rest of her life. And interestingly, as this developed over time, because this did take a number of sessions, the half-brothers became more concerned with the well-being of their half-siblings. And even though they didn't have a relationship with him and they were very unhappy with their father, they said, you know what? I actually, good or bad, I have some half-siblings, and I would like to be sure if my father's estate is going to be used in some manner or another for their benefit, that it's used prudently. And they're really legitimately being taken care of and trying to find a method and a structure which was, never palatable, which was not completely repugnant to the family with regard to having. And then also because there was a lot of different methods of course, calculating somebody's wealth. Usually you're looking at child support, not just premised upon net wealth, but upon net income. What do you have every month to use to support children? This guy was dead. So the argument was he didn't have any net income anymore, even though he had some substantial assets. So we had to really wrestle with full disclosure of assets, full disclosure of any income producing assets. So that took a substantial, of course, and people can hide assets. So we really had to have a very comprehensive financial disclosure. Ultimately, I ask when I'm having a financial disclosure, not just for somebody to give a financial statement, but I really want to have raw documents, meaning bank statements, tax returns that you can glean, what different assets they may have that are being loaded into the tax return. So after we had that very comprehensive financial disclosure, there was still, of course, a big debate as to what it meant as far as what was going to have to be paid under the respective child support laws. So we also had another very difficult issue. Wasn't as difficult as I am to find out. There is a very sophisticated bunch of laws and conventions and treaties with regard to international child support issues. Most of the time it's dealing with a parent that is abroad with a child that's in the United States, and you're trying to enforce a support order against somebody out of the country. And there's about 75 or a whole bunch of countries with which the United States has treaties. Japan isn't one of them. And they were at least debating as to what right this Japanese mother had to come into the United States and do a California court and have a support order enforced here for her benefit. It was ultimately a conclusion that she probably did have that right because the estate was in California. And she did have counsel present, but I will tell you this. I did not ever speak to her, by the way, but they had a Japanese interpreter, and she did not have a clue as to what was going on in this entire forum. She didn't know he was married. She didn't know he had other children. She was a complete deer in the headlights, but yet she had this infant that she was having to raise, and he had been completely supporting her and the infant for quite some period of time, and she had no means of support. So that was another very challenging thing. In light of the fact the Japanese mother had no means of support, and the brothers, as time came along, wanted to be sure that their sibling in Japan did have a reasonable lifestyle. So not only did they need to find a method of supporting the child, but also the mother. And interestingly enough, one of the arguments was a Marvin claim. If you call Marvin versus Marvin, the implied contract. So what the Japanese, the lawyer for the Japanese mother was arguing, because there was a Marvin claim, because he'd been supporting her for quite some long period of time and supporting the child. So there was a Marvin claim that was kind of woven in all to this kind of complex legal background. So also participating in this mediation was the in vitro company, because they had been sued in a separate action by the wife, claiming that they had been negligent in allowing Susan to come in and forge Bill's signature and impregnating her, and it should be the in vitro company that should be liable for whatever the financial responsibilities were that the estate would have. And of course, handling those all at one time was not easy, because the wife is saying, I don't want to just sit here and agree that I'm going to pay X amount per month or establish a trust fund or whatever it is. I want to know how much I'm going to get from the in vitro company so I know what my total exposure really is. So quick movement ahead with regard to the in vitro company, because there was a settlement with regard to the estate and the children. The in vitro company, very talented trial lawyer. I did not think that the in vitro company, there was a cold shot in hell that they could be found liable when they'd been defrauded. They took that case to trial, and they hit the in vitro company for over $1 million. That case was overturned on appeal on substantial evidence, which everyone here knows, very challenging to have a case overturned on substantial evidence, but it was fundamentally causation, that it had to be for and foreseeability. It had to be foreseeable that a woman in Susan's position, after the guy dies, would forge his signature to come into the facility and be impregnated. And I think the Court of Appeal just concluded as a matter of law, that's just such an aberrant type of behavior that it would not be foreseeable that even if somebody was forging a signature, that the purpose of that signature would be to have a posthumous pregnancy. That's very, very...
Brad, yeah. let me just interject something here, because the complexity of these legal issues can be utilized in various ways in mediation. But at the core of all of this, you have emotional issues, right? So without getting into what the solution was quite yet, what did you do to approach organizing this, organizing the agenda? What would be approached first? Things of that nature.
So let me tell you what I sent a template out separately, by the way, to each council, kind of like a risk chart, mm-hmm. because we not only had to deal with the emotions, we had to think, had to have the wife and the two sons get into a position where they could say, well, I'm just not going to do it because I'm angry and I'm mad and Susan's a bad person. Okay, but you're in a judicial system. And so I would enumerate the issues and that you're now going to delegate to a judge who will make a decision with regard to issues of paternity, right to child support, rights of respective ability to pay, who's going to manage the money, and you're going to be giving that up to somebody else. So part of that risk management, you know, trying to have people not, they can't ever divorce themselves from the emotional side of it, but they have to be aware, I think at one level, almost every mediation, that this is your going forward risk and alternative. Somebody else is going to decide all these issues. This is a decision you're making with regard to this family, very difficult family dispute. Which would you like? Would you like the court to go ahead and make all these complex, both personal and financial decisions? Or would you rather come to some accommodation that you don't like, but at least you have some say-so and some control over? So that was a substantial part of going through and getting a yes.
Well, we're going to take another break at this point, and we're going to be getting into how essentially this plate of spaghetti was untangled. And we will do that on the other side of the break. I'm Len Levy, and we're talking with Brad Benning.
Masters of Dispute Resolution is sponsored by the National Academy of Distinguished Neutrals. NADN is the premier invitation-only association of civil mediators and arbitrators in the United States, with members in every state of the nation. Only experienced ADR professionals who are widely acceptable to local plaintiff and defense firms are invited to join the Academy's roster. The Academy's website, NADN.org, is the most widely visited neutrals database in the world today, with over 40,000 law offices, insurance companies, and corporations visiting our free website annually. Firms can search for neutrals by many criteria, including location, case expertise, qualifications, language skills, and most NADN members also publish their available dates, calendars, online, making NADN.org the go-to website for law firms wishing to schedule appointments online with their preferred mediators. For more information, please visit www.nadn.org today.
Welcome back to Masters of Dispute Resolution. I'm Len Levy, and Brad Benning is telling us a story of a very complex mediation that he conducted some time back. And this took a number of days, Brad, but you had to pull a lot together, as you've just described.
It was clear, you know, some matters are like this. So I indicated earlier we had kind of original mediation to say, what do we have to do to get this ready? One, we had to have paternity established. Two, we had the financial records that had been disclosed. We then had another session that we did not call a money session. It was really, where are we now, folks? Where do you have everything you need? The lawyers have information to make informed recommendations. The parties did participate in those specific contracts. I felt the more involvement they had with the lawyers and with the issues, hearing about not just the technical things, but the risks they had in going forward, monetarily and even emotionally what might happen. That was important. So a second session, I think it was probably 60 days after the first one. Then after that session that was about 60 days after the first one, we had a final session that was approximately 45 to 60 days after that. Part of that process was as well me providing kind of independent assessments to each side as to what I'd heard out of the mediation. And the lawyers, and they were very good at this, by the way, spending some time with their clients with those issues and with the alternatives to have calmed things down and really be talking about the productive things we can do toward resolution. Because in that second session, we had gone through a menu of options as far as what we might do to provide support for these children in a way that the wife could possibly choke down. As you might imagine, there's a menu of different options. And also, by the way, there's legal requirements as to what obligations Bill's estate would have that had to be kind of intertwined in with what the wife was or not prepared to do. And she had to come to grips with the fact that Bill's estate ultimately is probably going to be responsible for supporting these children on one level or another. And that was very difficult for her to come to grips with, and that there are legal formulas as to how that child support may be paid. So the wife's attitude was, I just want to write a check to them and have them go away. And we kind of came to the conclusion, well, there may be mechanisms of doing that, but you're not just going to be able to pay, you know, Susan $500,000 and give Susan and have you be able to extinguish the obligation to provide child support. That's probably not going to be something that is ever going to be approved by the court. So the other things I'll tell you that were the real primary difficulty in getting this done, I'm a real believer that even if you have many, many complex legal issues and many, many difficult things that may have to be resolved and discussed for people to have in context when they're making settlement decisions, at some point you have to sit down and say, okay, now we've talked about those. What are the deal points? We've got to start putting these on paper. We have to have bullet points. And we have to start thinking about how is that going to get drafted and manifested into a final settlement agreement. And with these parties in particular, I will tell you that I'm a real believer in mediations, especially if they have any complexity to it. Sending a lawyer home to their own devices and doing settlement agreements to me can just be a catastrophe, because every lawyer, many lawyers have their own paragraphs they think are essential and important that may be meaningless in the context of an ultimate settlement. So I worked with the lawyers in crafting a settlement agreement that was very comprehensive. All together, by the way, first the bullet points were developed all together. Then I actually, with the help of one of the lawyers who was a trust and estates person, because it was kind of a trust and estates issue, we crafted a master document. So the document came basically from one of the lead counsel and myself and was distributed to everyone. Then everyone reconvened and we had a live meeting where we're with, you know, I've got my computer and trying to scribble and trying to edit things while we're all in the same room together. So the ultimate conclusion was something that you might have forecast. There was no mechanism, for the wife just to make a lump sum payment to Susan or to the woman in Japan and have confidence that the money was going to be managed in a way for the best interest of the kids, or even in a manner that the court would ultimately approve, because this was going to require court approval. The wife was not interested in some forever hereinafter. I've got to write checks every month, knowing that these checks, just emotional, I'm sitting down writing out a check to Susan every month. That is going to be completely unpalatable to me. We need to figure out some other mechanism for us to manage this. So the brothers and the two sons, they were very competent, very able. One of them in particular was a business person. He volunteered to be a trustee in conjunction with a professional trustee. So there was an agreement as far as the structure that a separate trust would be arranged for each one of these children. There would be co-trustees, which would be the brother, the half-brother, and the mother would not have to have any involvement. And the professional trustee would be the person who, you know, wrote the checks and do all the things that are on the legal side to make sure no money was going to the right place and the right amounts and so on. The brother was really more involved in the trustee's function of making sure how the money was spent and the money being spent in prudence on behalf of the kids. Because he's, you know, the young kids, especially the infants, they are going to have, 16, 17 years of support, including, are they going to go to private school? Or is there going to be a college fund? A whole variety of things we planned. So it ended up being a fairly creative and practical approach to resolution where the you know, the brother son would handle kind of the personal side of things, and the professional fiduciary would handle the business side of things. That agreement probably took four sessions to finally hash out as to what the powers were going to be that the brother would have, because you might imagine Susan, these are her kids, at least the three of them are, she wanted to run things. She didn't want the brother to be telling her what she was going to be doing with her kids. She didn't want him to be overseeing, you know, looking over. Of course, the brother did not have the most delightful relationship with Susan, as you might imagine at this point, because he had been his father's lover and he had all these other kids and had lied to the family. So their inner relationship was going to be very difficult. So by the way, we also developed a mechanism that if there ended up being a dispute between the trustees or the brother and Susan over any of the issues in managing the children's life or how much money they would get in the future, I was actually appointed as an arbitrator if they could not reach agreements. And I've done that a number of times. The reason is not because you're ever going to be an arbitrator. They know you'll make a decision and they never come back to you because they know you will make a decision. But there needed to be some mechanism where if they reached an impasse, they weren't going to just be going back into court again and saying the trustee's not doing their job, they're not giving me enough money, or the woman who's managing the beneficiaries, the Susan, she's not feeding them the right kind of stuff, or she's not going to send them to the right kind of schools, or she's not getting the right kind of tutoring they need. You can imagine the number of things that could arise with regard to that relationship. The other thing that had to be negotiated, which, you know, siblings don't technically have any visitation rights, but these brothers who had come around over a period of time realizing my father may have been, you know, off the reservation, but these are babies. These little kids deserve to have brothers and an upbringing, to have a family. And so one of the more complex things to develop, even though the very good family lawyers were able to come to grips with it, was visitation rights for the brothers and the kind of exposure and access they would have to their siblings. And indeed, one of the brothers, I think, it became very close to the son who had been 12 years old. And I think they joined scouts and did a bunch of stuff together. So they ended up having a productive relationship going forward. I don't know what happened with the little kids because this was some time ago. And so I'm not sure what that relationship was. But in any event, we had to negotiate visitation rights. And also, by the way, if those visitation rights were going to be modified, I was in essence appointed as a referee where they could just come to me. Because they couldn't reach an agreement as to weekends and who's going to, you know, pick them up and who's going to drop them off and all that kind of stuff. They could come to somebody on an expedited basis and have that resolved. I never heard a word from anybody.
Either as a referee or as an arbitrator.
Not as a referee and not as an arbitrator. And I have many times, especially in when the people have to do things in a settlement as opposed to just pay money. And there may be a debate as to whether they've, you know, fixed something they say they're going to fix, or they've moved the boundary line to where they say they're going to move it, or whatever it is. I've many times had myself installed as the dispute resolution mechanism. And the reason is because they'll usually keep together. They'll usually make sure they're acting reasonably toward one another. Because I tell them, look, folks, I'll come in and make a decision if you need me to. But I will tell you, if you can modify your own, you want to do it informally, that's fine. If you are civil to each other and you all get along and you work hard, great. If you're not, then you do have an expedited method of having this addressed. It's not expensive. It's not difficult. The lawyers would be advising me of the problem. I'd be having conference calls. I can't have any ex-party communications, but if you allow me to, I could still wade into the problem and see if we can resolve it as a neutral. If you agree that I can have ex-party communications, and if not, I will have evidence that comes with regard to the complaints you both have, and I will issue an order. And so you know that this will get resolved, folks. It's not going to be left open.
This is something that is utilized in construction. It's almost like the binding mediation clauses in construction contracts.
It is. It is something, especially when you have, I have a lot of complex construction transactional mediations where somebody's going to walk off the job and this, you're not approving this change order. We have these big back charges because you screwed stuff up. And the parties are then agreeing on what they're going to do going forward, which may involve payment, but usually it also involves who's going to do what and what plan or spec are you going to follow. And so it's very common, whether it's myself or they appoint the architect or somebody else, to be appointed as a dispute resolution mechanism, which of course is in a lot of construction cases as well, but in a settlement agreement for that dispute, to have some third party, very often it's me, is going to be appointed so they know. We have a quick method of getting rid of this issue if we got a problem. And so these parties all knew that I, with level of sensitivity and wanting to hear what they were talking about, wanting to hear from both sides thoroughly as to what the problem was, but I would either issue orders of enforcement with regard to the agreement that had been reached, or I had the ability to modify the orders just like a referee would in a family law context, to modify the orders according to changed circumstances. You never know. When you got a kid that's 2 years old, all the changes in circumstances that might have happened over the next 18 years. And again, I've never heard a thing. I have informally seen the lawyers at various bar functions and so on. And, you know, they are in touch with their clients to some extent. As far as I know, that settlement agreement, although I'm quite confident there were glitches along the way, that settlement agreement has resulted in a better result than I really could have ever imagined, especially when this challenging emotional case showed up in my doorstep with everyone going every which way without any possible method of direction. So that resolution was one of my more satisfying resolutions. I tell you, and all of you know this when you deal with really good lawyers that are trying to come to creative results, it wasn't just my creativity, by the way, putting this together. These lawyers really worked hard, tried to come up with solutions they felt their clients could live with, that the other side could live with, that was going to be productive in giving the other side a bone when you were going to get something. So it's trying to do some tit for tat. It was really, really handled as a family matter after the legal stuff kind of was something we really hashed out. Everybody understood what they were and weren't obligated to do and probably what their risks were. It was then productive in being handled as we need to resolve what is a very difficult and ugly family dispute. And it was resolved. So it's one of those things I have told people in summary form, that fact pattern saying, I got to tell you something. If you saw this in a made-for-TV movie, you said, oh, that's so implausible. That could never happen. Where somebody has two children 11 months after they passed away. Nobody's going to believe that in a screenplay. And this fact pattern was so unbelievable. I say that to people and I say, is that real? Did that really happen? And by the way, it's interesting. I didn't know there is a whole host of law throughout Australia, United Kingdom, not as much in the United States, even Canada, about posthumous pregnancies. Some of them are planned. Some of them are where they will actually go and remove sperm from a dead body because for a variety of reasons. Yeah. So there's a whole, it's fairly unique, obviously, but if you go put Google posthumous pregnancy, I'm quite confident you will find all of these articles dealing with a very eclectic, eccentric issue as to who has the right to it. Does the parents of the deceased have a right? Is it the partner of the deceased who has the right? So that was part of what we were dealing with in this case. Of course, we had that additional wrinkle that it was a posthumous pregnancy with the in vitro company involved. So very, very unique wrinkle.
Well, Brad, this was a fantastic demonstration of your ability to grasp what needed to be done and to have the buy-in from the parties on numerous levels, it appears. And one of them is to trust that you've established the trust. You wouldn't have been appointed as in these various roles you've described without the parties having that trust. So it sounds very much like you not just achieved a settlement of legal disputes, but you also resolved a conflict that existed and headed off conflicts in the future.
Well, with 2020 hindsight, that's true. I didn't think that the agreement to have me as a referee was going to end up with never having to do anything. Yeah. So with 2020 hindsight, it looks really good. I was thinking I was going to have to wade back into it one time or another. But fortunately, I think because reasonable minds have prevailed, I also think that the brothers in developing a relationship with their half-siblings was probably very critical this entire, you know, post-settlement success.
Right.
And so I think that part of it was absolutely an element that ended up, over the long run, making that settlement satisfying.
Well, Brad, thank you. I wish we had more time to discuss it, but we're pretty much at the end now. And I really, really appreciate your coming on and spending the time with us and I hope the takeaways are those that can be very universally applied. Mediators for attorneys. But in any event, Brad, I know you can be reached through ADR Services in the Northern California, which office you normally work out of?
I work out of all Oakland, San Jose, and San Francisco kind of almost equally. And I also do stuff in Los Angeles and San Diego as well.
Okay. So, Brad, again, thank you. And as we wrap up, I want to thank Daryl Wayne, our engineer and producer. And I'm your host, Len Levy. And this is Masters of Dispute Resolution on podclips.io, powered by Infigen Labs. I hope you will continue to enjoy the stories we bring you. And in the meantime, stay well, keep listening, and remember, peace of mind is enhanced when conflicts are resolved.
If you wish to contact Len Levy, you can reach him through his email at lslevy@adrservices.com, through Len's website, lenlevymediate.com, telephone him at 818-903-5562, or contact his case manager at ADR Services, 213-683-1600.